Okay, I think we'll get started this morning for our final session this week on Genesis. For those who have been not with us this week, we're working with Genesis on the themes of my recent book, Come Out, My People, which I understand the bookstore got some more copies of yesterday, so it's down there if you're interested. The basic point of what we're doing out of the book is what I call in the book the struggle in the Hebrew scripture between these two religions, the religion of creation and the religion of empire. And here are the characteristics across a variety of features, as you can see. We're going to focus on one of those in particular today as we look at Genesis 18 and 19, and that's this question of the relationship with unknown others. What do you do when there are strangers around? And Genesis presents as sharp a contrast in responding to the same precise strangers as you could imagine. Clearly presenting one as the positive response and one as the negative response. And yet that negative response, as we'll explore, is the one that most of us practice most of the time. Maybe not as extremely as the Sodomites, but how many of us, when a stranger showed up at the door, would say, "Come on in, I'll stop everything I'm going to do and provide you with extravagant hospitality." So, lest we start off saying, "Those doggone Sodomites," maybe they're not that far from where we live. And I want to reserve enough time today, since it's our last session, to just point ahead to a couple other elements of the book of Genesis, and then to point even farther ahead to how hearing Genesis through this lens of the two religions can help us hear more clearly elements of the gospel of Jesus. So we'll go to a couple of places in the New Testament where the work we've done this week might help us to get some clarification, at least suggest some ways. And if any of you are going to be here next week, I'll be working not in the Bible study time, but in the quote-unquote theology time. I don't like the label because I don't really think of what I do as theology. But anyway, I'll be working with New Testament texts next week, one from each four Gospels and one from the book of Revelation. So we'll get a chance to kind of cross to the other side of this if you're going to be with us next week. So yesterday we looked at the call of Abram in chapter 12 and his hearing this unidentified voice that we as readers know is the God by the name Yahweh, and he doesn't know, though, apparently, and yet he listens, and he goes to this place that only God will show him. And in contrast was his nephew Lot. And Lot, as we saw in Genesis 13, looking out with his own eyes at the well-watered plain, which reminded him of Egypt and the garden of God, settled there. And the narrator tells us that's bad by saying it was near Sodom. And before we get to the passage about Sodom, just to connect the narrative context of where we were in chapter 13 and where we are now in chapter 18. In chapter 14, as I mentioned briefly yesterday, Lot is taken captive in a war between neighboring kings, two coalitions of neighboring kings. And Abraham, for the only time in his life, has to engage in violence to rescue Lot. He hires a mercenary army to get Lot out. And of course, without getting into details now, the aftermath of that is the famous, often taken out of context, Melchizedek scene, where Melchizedek offers to pay Abraham for what he's done, and Abraham says, "No way, I'm not a mercenary, I'm just trying to get my nephew out of here." So he goes on. In the intervening chapters, from chapter 15 to 17, Abram in chapter 15, has two more encounters with this God. One in chapter 15 is the mysterious, so-called covenant of the pieces, where he has this vision at night. He's supposed to cut these animals in half, and God comes in the midst of that, and we won't get into that, but that's just one of the stories there. In chapter 17 is the covenant established by circumcision. And it's at a point where Abram, of course, has been with this God now for a number of years, five chapters, but a number of years, and now there's this explicit promise of children coming, but, you know, they're getting older, not younger. And so that leads us up to the scene we have here, chapter 18. And before we look at 18 and 19, I just want to give you one glimpse here of one of the themes that links these two chapters around the question of outsiders and the other, which is the relationship between inside and outside spaces, both structural spaces and human spaces. One of the key themes in these chapters is who gets to enter and by what means. And so in our first scene, there's the question of the entrance of the tent. In the Sodom scene, there's several layers: the entrance to the city at the gate, the entrance of Lot's house, the entrance of his sons-in-law's house, and then finally, when Lot reaches his lowest place, in a cave, the result of his making the wrong choices, there's the question of entrance into him, and vice versa, with his daughters. So the story takes a definite downward turn as we go through it. So I'd like to just highlight a couple of things here, because as I say, I want to make sure we save some time to look at a couple other things in Genesis. But do feel free to jump in, ask questions, or anything else you might like. This is also, I think, one of the funniest scenes in Genesis. So those of you who have already indicated this week that you're prepared to see the Bible, how funny the Bible is, I hope we can recognize the humor here. One element is obviously funny, I hope you can see, and one element is funny in a way that the translation doesn't always show. So here they are by the oaks of Mamre, or the terebinth, depending on your translation, at the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. Now, just a reminder, where in the world is this? What part of the world are we talking about here?
Palestine.
Yeah. So heat of the day.
Hot.
Hot. You know, like so many hot places in the world, in the middle of the day you just stop. So here at the heat of the day, surprisingly, are these three people just standing there. Seemingly out of nowhere. Huh? And note the speed and urgency with which Abram responds to these three strangers. He doesn't say, "Who are you? What are you doing here? What do you want?" He just runs. And he's an old man, right? He runs from the tent entrance to meet them. Bow to the ground. "My Lord, if I find favor with you, do not pass by your servant. A little water be brought and wash your feet," etc. And so, Abram hastened into the tent of Sarah. "Make ready quickly 3 measures of choice flour, knead it, and make cakes." Faster than Holden can do it, huh? And Abraham ran to the herd, took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the servant who hastened to prepare it. Like, this isn't like pulling something out of the freezer and throwing it in the microwave. Right? Quick, prepare the calf. Like, that's a lot of work in the middle of the day, right? You got to kill it, you got to skin it, slaughter it, cook it. You know, it's not like they've got a stove. I mean, this is an enormous amount of work that's being presented here. All in this big hurry by old people to strangers. You know, it's an astounding scene. And then the curds and the milk is a luxury item. You know, milk, of course, has to be immediately fresh. It's not like they're pulling that out of the reach-in refrigerator, huh? And set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree while they ate. Now there's hospitality. Right? It doesn't get any more extravagant than that. And the text does everything it can to indicate the extravagance, you know, from the heat of the day to the hurrying to a feast as if it was the king. You know, I mean, ordinary people didn't eat meat on a regular basis. You know, meat was a luxury item. And of course, it isn't just meat. It says, took a calf tender and good, like the best they've got. Nothing's too good for strangers. Now, that's an attitude toward the other. And of course, it's in tremendous contrast with the Sodomites, as we'll see. I want to highlight the one other element of the story that's not directly about hospitality, and I know it's a little askew of the theme here, but it's, of course, the purpose of why they're there, because it's funny in a way that, as they say, one is obvious and one's not. So So while Abraham is standing by them under the tree, they said, "Where's your wife Sarah?" And he said, "They're in the tent." And of course we hear in the second half of verse 10 that she's at the entrance. The tent, of course, is itself, like the city, a womb symbol. The great historian of city life, Lewis Mumford, who, if you don't know his book, The City and History, which was written in the 60s, and is still a fabulous set of insights on the role of cities in human history. Mumford was a city planner by training, but became a historian of cities because he came to see that in the 60s, when suburbia was really getting going and sprawl was really getting going, that unless people had some sense of historical perspective on what cities were for, you know, it would just kind of just spread aimlessly, which of course is what happened for several decades until people sort of put some halt and say, maybe we need to stop and think about this. But he talks about the city as having two metaphorical functions. It's a magnet and it's a container. It's a magnet, obviously, and drawing people to it. And it's a container in that it's like a prison. It holds people inside it. And he highlights that the city is primarily a female symbol in the ancient world. Not in our world, because, you know, cities are spread out. But in the ancient world, a wall and a gate defined a city. And I don't need to explain why that's a female symbol. Huh? And so is a tent, a female symbol. And Sarah is at the entrance of the tent while the conversation is about whether she's going to get pregnant. Fitting, huh? And the text is obviously trying to draw the relationship here. And so it highlights as if we'd forgotten. Now, they were old, advanced in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, and I want to translate 12 the way it really sounds. After I have become withered and my husband is old, shall I have moisture? The contrast is explicitly between dryness and wetness. And, you know, as Sue has been talking some in her work about prayer and the life of spiritual practice as being earthy. And one reason we've lost that is our translations have covered it over. Because the translators are embarrassed about it, apparently. You know? The idea of an old lady talking about her female moisture is something that can't be in the Bible. The Bible wouldn't be about things like that. Why wouldn't it? Why wouldn't it? I mean, isn't that part of God's creation? Isn't that part of the natural way in which bodies react and the response of another that you're drawn to? It's not like it's bad. It's not dirty. I'm thinking of Sharon. Is Sharon here today? She's not here this morning. But she talked yesterday at length about the disgust factor in relation to disability, but also more broadly of how there are certain things that we've been socially conditioned to respond to as yuck, or to avert our eyes, or to not want to talk about it. Why would sexuality be one of those? Oh, why would the ways that bodies obviously naturally are made to respond to prepare them for the joy of coming together in this intimacy be something we'd want to hide from talking about? That's partly a rhetorical question, but, you know, partly not. I hope you'll think about that. And the text in its Hebrew does not. So, and of course, the contrast between dry and wet is the issue for the Israelites in general in this dry climate. When we looked at the Garden of Eden, of course, it says, and moisture arose from the garden, and the four rivers flow out of it. And that's not a coincidence, because the word for describe pleasure here is the Hebrew Edna, which is cognate with Eden. It's basically the same word. So the word Eden basically means abundant moisture, the garden of abundant moisture, which for a desert people is paradise. To just have moisture flowing up out of the ground is paradise. Because the Israelites otherwise had to carefully contain the little bit of rainfall that part of the world gets, and it was precious, and there was often not enough. So the idea that water is just flowing and moisture is flowing means life. So notice that Sarah's not asking about having children. The visitors, the men, the angels, Their theme is children, and her theme is moisture. You know? And then, of course, they have this wonderful exchange where in verse 14, and it says, at the set time I'll return to you in due season, Sarah will have a son. But Sarah denied, saying, verse 13, why did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I indeed bear a child now that I'm old? Which, of course, is not what she said. Right? But then Sarah denies, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. He said, oh, yes, you did laugh. And you can't help but laugh. Huh? I want to highlight something about the word laughter here. The verb to laugh is very closely related to the son that's going to come of this. The son is Isaac. The verb is Yitzhak. So basically they're saying, you know, I didn't Yitzhak. Yes, you did Yitzhak. Is it about the laughter or is it about the son? Are those different things? It's very important at the Sodom and Gomorrah story, which we're going to get to right now, too. It's also important, just parenthetically, in chapter 26 in Genesis, the third of the Say You're My Sister stories. Right, we looked at the one in chapter 12 with Abraham, or Abram at the time, telling Sarah, go tell Pharaoh you're my sister, not my wife. And he does it again in chapter 20 with somebody else, and Isaac, apparently learning from his dad, does the same thing. And the way that the king in chapter 26 knows that Isaac and Rebekah are not brother and sister is he sees them yitzhaking with each other. Now, you might think, well, what's wrong with that? They're laughing? But the word yitzhak carries some connotations like we have in English. For words that have multiple connotations. It also means, in a sense, playing with. And it means playing with in the same way that English playing with can be positive or negative. One of the things that Sarah sees Ishmael doing with Isaac is playing with him, and then she says, send them out of here. And one of the issues there is, why is she upset about him, Ishmael, playing with Isaac? Is it, well, that the son of the slave girl and the son of the promise of this story here shouldn't be connected? Or is it, as the ancient rabbis saw it, a question of child abuse? That the older boy was playing with, say, fondling Isaac. Which is at least the interpretation of it that the king in chapter 26 thinks when he sees Isaac yitzhaking with his wife. Fondling in a way that you wouldn't properly be doing with your sister. And he says, oh, it's his wife. I can see from what they're doing, it's his wife.
Is it possible that Sarah was yitzhaking with herself here?
Interesting question. Interesting question. Yeah. I'll just let that one hang there. That's okay. Yeah. All right. So as the story proceeds, for the sake of time, I've got to move along here a little bit. There's going to be the promise, and we'll come back next year, and sure enough, it'll happen. Meanwhile, in verse 20, Yahweh says, apparently to Yahweh's own self, or to the us that we've seen earlier, although here it's singular as opposed to the plural, both in Genesis 1 and in the Tower of Babel story, Genesis 11, where it's we or us. How great is the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah, and how very grave their sin. I must go down and see whether they have done together according to the outcry that has come to me, and if not, I will know. Okay. Now, I want to highlight a couple things in this story. I assume you've heard the story before, of course. It's one of the most hideously abused stories in the book of Genesis. I mean, a lot of Genesis is abused for all kinds of reasons, but some of the other abuse is more silly than, you know, deadly. You know, it's silly to think that Genesis is saying the world was made in six literal days, or you can count how old the planet is by counting the years in Genesis. But the consequences of misreading this story are not silly. They're violent and terrible. So I want to highlight a couple things that makes that clear. The verb for outcry here is precisely the same verb that God hears the Israelites crying out in Egypt. It's the cry of oppressed people. Almost always social and economic oppression. So that's the outcry that Yahweh hears that he's going to respond to. And for the sake of time, I'm going to skip the fabulous exchange that, you know, is pretty self-explanatory between Abraham and Yahweh, where Abraham convinces Yahweh to be more lenient. You know? Teaches Yahweh a lesson about what justice is. You know, which is an astounding statement of Israel's understanding of the relationship between humans and God. Huh? You know, for those of us who come in with a Greek idea of God, rather than a biblical idea of God, with all these omnis around God, that God is, you know, all perfect and has all the answers and knows everything, what do you do with this story? Among many other stories that show people, like Moses does. Moses talks to God the same kind of way and says, you know, this people you've given me, and, you know, what are you going to do about it? Your reputation is really going to be bad if this people that you pulled out of Egypt rebels, and you better do something about it for the sake of your reputation. You know, and this is a similar thing here. I mean, shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? You're going to look like a bad God if you sweep away the innocent with the guilty. And Yahweh's perfectly willing to say, okay, you're right. I note that in the face of later quote-unquote Christian violence, and I know Joe here knows some of the references to the repression, say, of the Cathars, among others, where the Pope's representative, faced with a city full of people, some of whom were deemed to be heretics, and the question was, how are we going to know which ones are which? And he famously said, kill them all, God will sort it out. How far that is from the sense of God's justice in this story. That Abraham convinces God it would not be just to kill the innocent along with the guilty. And God says, you're right. Thank you for reminding me of that. You know? So, unfortunately, there aren't 10 just people in Sodom, so the fate comes out the same anyway. So let's look at one more thing that highlights the structure of this passage. I just want to highlight to give you some big picture, if I can get the whole thing almost in the on the screen here. So as we looked at with another scene, with the Tower of Babel and another one, this forms what we call a chiasm, a set of mirrored pairs from the beginning to the end. So it starts and ends at Mamre. It has this outside of Sodom perspective, and then it comes closer to Sodom, and then it goes inside the city, and then it goes inside or Lot's house as the center, and then comes back out the other way. So I want to highlight that so you can see this kind of concentric movement into these female spaces and what's going on in the story. So the same two, now they're named as angels, the men, the visitors who were in Abraham and Sarah's tent area, come to Sodom in the evening. And Lot was sitting in the gateway of Sodom. People have any sense of what the gate, the role of a gate in the city is? Obviously, it's an entrance point, but otherwise, what it was, what do you know? It was the place for justice. So, some of the prophets talk about you deny justice at the gate. So, if you experience some oppression in the city, you're supposed to go to the gate and say, you know, so-and-so wronged me, and then you have witnesses, and you know what was their version of the trial. So Lot's sitting in the gate of Sodom, gateway of Sodom. And when Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground, which is indicating, but doesn't say, that he had to have let them in. Because the gate would be closed. That's the point of having the gate. It's evening. So he let them in. That's the big problem here. That's the issue. And I want to highlight this because what the Sodomites see is what they want to do to the visitors is what the visitors have done to them. Entered their gate without permission. So their basic argument is, you know, if you want to enter our gate without permission, we'll enter your gate without permission. Gate of your body. Okay. So it's not about homosexuality. In any way, shape, or form. It's about what city people do to unwanted visitors. and they see their offer to quote-unquote know them as a poetically just response to what's happened to them. Because that's how city people respond to strangers. You're not welcome. So Lot says, please, my lords or sirs, turn aside your servant's house and spend the night, wash your feet, and then you can rise early and go on your way. No, we will spend the night in the square. You might note that that echoes very closely the response of the two disciples on the road to Emmaus to Jesus in Luke 24, which is modeled on this scene here. The verb is the same, the urging. So when it's night is coming and they're in Emmaus, and it looks like Jesus is going to walk on further, and they say, no, you know, stay here, not in the square, and they urged him, and he goes into the house, just like here. It's also parallel to the response to Lydia and the women of Philippi in Acts 16, to the presence of Paul, which is to say, three points on the biblical line of being in the city square at night isn't safe. So offering hospitality to visitors in the city is to take them into your house because the public square is not a safe place to be at night. And, you know, it would be the same thing if you lived downtown somewhere and you'd say, it's not safe to stay on the streets downtown Seattle at night by yourself. You know, urge you to come in. Okay. And again, we won't look at all the details, but he says he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread and they ate. It says a feast, the Hebrew word for the feast is like a drinking feast, really. It's more like they had drinks and snacks and bread. Hardly the hospitality that Abraham offered, but still he's welcoming them. He's not ignoring them. He's making it his business to invite them in. But before they lay down, the men of the city, notice again the universality of this. The men of the city, the men of Sodom, young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house. And I'm not going to point at every detail of the female container imagery here, but you can hopefully see it for yourself. And they called to Lot, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. And it's quite certainly a play on words that in the text originally that they get and we get, that they don't mean they'd like to get to be friends with them. And so Lot goes out of the door. Notice again the movement. So the angels are inside. Lot goes out of the door, shut the door after him, and says, I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Look, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please. Now, I think hideously, some commentators have somehow tried to justify that as if ancient hospitality would put the role of visitors, the duty to visitors, over the duty of your daughters. Nonsense. He's offering to let people rape his daughters rather than attack the visitors. What this text is showing, there are a number of other examples of this in Genesis that I could suggest to you outside of our time today, is that when you first make a choice that wasn't God's choice for you, you're left with bad choices. The only thing you can do when you've made the wrong choice is undo the choice somehow. Once you say, well, I already made that choice, I already live in Sodom, Lot, of course, already knows that Sodom is a dangerous place to live. Abraham had to rescue him from this war, and he went back and settled there again. Didn't learn from his mistake. He should have said, I think city life is dangerous. I think I should have learned from my uncle. I should just keep moving and not be settled in these places where there's violence as a way to respond to the other. But no, he's there. So, and that's so often us. Again, I don't want to sermonize on this too much, but I hope you can hear there are countless implications for when we've made a major life choice that isn't directed by listening to God and doing what God wants. Then we're often faced with a series of choices, none of which are what God would have us do. Because it was the first choice that set us in the wrong place. And from that place, there aren't good choices. So that's what's happening here. Inside Sodom, there are no good choices for what Lot can do here. What's it going to be? Have his daughters raped or have the visitors raped? Which of those is God's will? You know, well, obviously neither of them are. God's will would have been, as we're going to see here, get the hell out of Sodom. Okay, so, but they're not interested in the daughters anyway. And notice that he calls them brothers, but they say, this fellow, and the word for fellow in Hebrew is a pejorative word, you know, this, whatever you want to say, came here as an alien and he'd play the judge. Like he's been here for a long time now. He's still not one of them. He's still an alien, you know. So they've tolerated him, and David here and Sharon have both talked about, you know, the kind of evils of toleration as a response. Because toleration still is recognizing there's basically a difference between us and you. And when the point comes that toleration is no longer acceptable, then that difference arises again and, you know, becomes a dividing point. So he's been there a long time, but now they say, you're just an alien. You're not one of us. And we'll deal worse with you than with them. And they pressed hard and came near the door to break it down. Of course, and we know how the story unfolds here. And then I want to bring up one more Yitzhaking thing. So while the people of Sodom are struck with angelically induced blindness, Lot is told by the angels, do you have anyone else here? Sons-in-law, sons, daughters, anyone you have in the city? Get, you know, like, are there 10? guess not. For we're about to destroy this place because the outcry against its people has become great before Yahweh, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and said to his son-in-laws who were to marry his daughters, up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city. But he seemed to his son-in-laws to be Yitzhaking. There in verse 14. You know, and I think one way to translate that would make sense of all those things, he seemed to be screwing around, or screwing with them, we might say. Or you can fill in another word if you want that, you know, would fit there too. Which carries the same set of connotations. It has a sexual connotation, has a sense of twisting the truth or playing with their minds or something. And because it's obvious, he seems absurd. What do you mean? I mean, imagine you're sitting there watching TV and somebody comes in and says, come on, let's go. The God's about to destroy this place. Yeah, come on. You know, they can hardly believe that there could be judgment on Sodom. So instead, he just takes his wife and his two daughters. But he lingered. Why do you think he's lingering?
He's reluctant to leave.
Why? Yeah, why? I mean, all the men of Sodom have just said, it's going to be worse for you, you alien, you would-be judge. I mean, why would you not want to get out of there? Somebody else had a hand too? Yeah, Judy?
I just said his stuff. I mean, that's what...
It's
stuff.
What?
He had all his things there.
Yeah.
It's his home. I mean...
It's home. One of the things that Genesis says and Exodus says, and all the religion of creation texts that are at that end of the spectrum, which is to say, I put up this chart, I won't get into it now, but just so those of you who weren't here when I did it know what I'm talking about. You know, this spectrum between the religion of empire texts and the religion of creation texts, some are at one end of the other and some are kind of in the middle. But the ones that are at the kind of pure, if you will, religion of creation side carry this consistent message here about what happens with city people when the call to come out, my people, arises. So when the Israelites are called out of Egypt, they leave. But what do? The moment Pharaoh's chariots and charioteers are in the sea,
they kind of start complaining. They want to go back.
They want to go back because that's where food is. So one of the things that's consistent between this message in Genesis and others, and the Exodus story, and other religion of creation, is there's a process of breaking an addiction that needs to happen for city people to learn how to be earth people. You know, Lot is basically addicted to the way of the city. The Israelites were addicted to empire. You know, you can think of the Exodus story as a 12-step program. Really, right? They have to rely on a higher, they have to admit they have an addiction. They have to rely on a higher power. You know, they have to get each other's support. to keep going, you know? And it takes a long time, one day at a time, across 40 years. You know, we get addicted to these systems that we know are leading us to death. But in the moment, they feel good. We'd feel empty without them. We don't know how to actually live a different way, because if you're an addict, your body is used to living that way. You don't literally know what it feels like not to have that. So Lot has been a city guy here. He's forgotten what it's like not to be one. And so he's lingering. And they seize him, and the Lord, being merciful to him, brought him out of the city and left him outside. And then said, "Flee for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the plain, or you'll be consumed." And then it gets even worse, and it's kind of a cartoon here. "Oh no, my lords, your servant has found favor with you, and you show me great kindness, but I cannot flee the hills, for fear disaster will overtake me. Look, that city is near enough to flee to, and it's just a little one." You know? Right? I mean, is it a matter of kind or degree? "It's just a little city, isn't that okay?" And he says, "Okay, we'll let you have Zoar." You know? Note that the run for the hills is echoed in the New Testament in Mark 13 and its parallels, where after the disciples are in awe of Jerusalem, "Master, look at these buildings, look at these stones." And he says, "It's all coming down. Not one stone's going to be left on another." And when you see that, when you see the destruction of Jerusalem, what are you supposed to do? Run for the hills. The fate of Jerusalem is no different than the fate of Sodom. A point made very explicitly in Revelation 11, where Sodom, Egypt, and Jerusalem are all likened as manifestations of, as we saw in chapter 11 in Genesis, the great city. So Yahweh rains sulfur and fire on Sodom and overthrew the cities. And of course we know about Lot's wife. And then just the bizarre and pathetic epilogue to the story is they're not even in Zoar in verse 30 and beyond, but they settled in the hills, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar, so now they're in a cave. Reduced to living in a cave. I mean, Abraham's just around the corner, right? Just up on the hill watching this happen. He could go with Abraham, you know, but no, they're hiding in a cave. And of course, this pathetic scene where the daughters think that the whole world's been destroyed, because to city people, if the city's destroyed, the whole world's destroyed. They have no sense of perspective on the wider creation that's available to them. And so they each consecutively get their father so drunk he doesn't notice that they've come into him. It's reversing the sense of the sexual imagery of coming in, but that's what it... That's how it's described here. The firstborn went in and lay with her father.
These are the same daughters he offered to them.
Yeah. His family's not on the best terms here, are they? I mean, at some level, they think they're doing a public service. Right? I mean, they think they're the last people on the earth. You know? And our father's an old man, so obviously we can't just openly say, "Dad, we need to have sex with you for the sake of keeping the human race going." It's only going to work if we get him drunk enough that he won't notice, which says a whole lot of other things too, but we won't get there. All right. So we hope you can hear in this, you know, what the point of sodomy is its diametric contrast with what Abraham and Sarah offered in chapter 18. And in case you think that's some modern and revisionist reading of it, let's see what the prophet Ezekiel, no liberal by anybody's measure, thinks about this. Here in chapter 16 of Ezekiel, he's talking to Jerusalem from exile in Babylon, from the same place that Genesis authors are talking, about what it was about Jerusalem that led to this. "As I live, says the Lord God, your sister, Jerusalem, sister Sodom, and her daughters," which are the smaller towns around, "have not done as you and your daughters have done. This was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and the needy." That's sodomy. That's sodomy. Having excess of food and not sharing it with the poor and needy. tell somebody that sometime. They want to use the Genesis text to make it about homosexuality. Huh? And of course, that's plainly what it's about in the New Testament too, when Jesus uses Sodom as an example to critique Jerusalem in his own time. And you know, and the flip side of the story here is how the Abraham story is held up as a model for Christians, as we see in the letter to Hebrews here. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing that, some have entertained angels without knowing it. An explicit reference back to the Genesis 18 story. So this is being presented in a set of teaching here about the kinds of behaviors that Christians should have in the presence of the empire as expressions of mutual love. Hospitality to strangers, remember those who are in prison as though you were in prison with them. Those who are being tortured, which of course is only by the empire, as though you yourselves are being tortured, a great text for what Sharon's been about. And keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. Okay, so a clear expression of the religion of creation. And any specific questions on the chapter 18 and 19 stories before I just point toward a couple things in Genesis and then make a couple of New Testament links to the bigger picture of what Genesis as part of the religion of creation is about. Any questions, observations on the two stories we've looked at today?
Can you talk about the nations that came from Lot and his daughters?
The Moabites. You notice it's not condemning them as such. It's certainly an insult to how they got started. But it's not saying, but you should treat them badly because of that. Reasons we can't unravel in history of what it was about the Moabites and their kin that led the authors of Genesis to say this is their origin. And there's not enough data from the ancient world. Like, you know, when they started this week, and could talk about Enuma Elish and the Babylonian creation story, we know a lot about ancient Babylon because, you know, they left a lot of remains being big imperial cities. But Moabites and folks, there's just not enough to know about, to know what was it about them in particular that lead these authors to single them out, to characterize them this way. So I wish I had a more concrete answer for you, but I don't.
I'm wondering if what you were saying about the entering the gates uninvited and the abuse that came from that, was that something that was a norm in other parts of the ancient world?
No, there's nothing to say that what the Sodomites are offering here is a normal practice. Everything about the story is extreme. Making a narrative point here. But what's quite plain is that cities were very willing to kill people who showed up uninvited. You know, to enter the city gates is to be seen as a spy, an invader somehow. It's not, I mean, we're relatively modest in calling people such hideous names as illegal aliens rather than just recognizing they're people without the proper paperwork. Likening them to being a different species, after all, like they're from another planet. And of course, we deny them health care, and they can't have all kinds of other things. And even in the health care debate that we had a couple years ago, Obama said quite flatly in relation to the charge, the horrible charge, he's proposing to give health care to illegal aliens. He says, of course I'm not. Of course I'm not proposing that. Right? So we're still not very far from that. We might not rape visitors directly, but in saying, of course we wouldn't provide health care for people who came here illegally, and of course, you know, if they came here with kids, years and years later, we would deport their kids, even though their kids have lived their whole life here. There's forms of, you know, direct violent response, and there's more indirect insidious things that may amount to the same thing in the long run. Okay, anything else on these two chapters? I want to highlight just one or two brief things. Joseph. You know, when Sue and I were doing our 2 years cycle on Genesis at our home, and we got to the Joseph story, a number of people were, to my mind, surprisingly upset in I'd like to think, reading Joseph according to the narrative, rather than reading Joseph according to their children's Bible. Do you come in thinking of Joseph's a good guy? Now I've set you up, right? Answer that honestly. But I mean, just honestly. I mean, do you think of it? Joseph is a good guy?
Yes.
What? Why? What's good about him?
He's forgiving.
But he tortures his brothers before he forgives them, after all. Right? Thank you. Right? I mean, he tortures his brothers and his father. Make them bring me Benjamin. Right? You know, his poor old dad, who didn't do anything wrong, as far as Joseph can tell. It's his brothers who wanted to kill him and then end up selling him. His brother favored him with the long sleeve coat. You know, famous coat of many colors, but literally long sleeve, which was enough to get his brothers to be jealous. And then he toys with them. He makes them go back and forth, you know, from Egypt to Palestine to Israel, like twice, and bring the younger brother, leave the father in this horrible thought of, I've already lost Joseph, what if I lose Benjamin? I mean, and then forgiving them is like makes it all okay, you think?
He also turned all the people in Egypt into slaves.
Yeah. And that's what I want to get to. See, the thing with toying with his brothers is one piece of it. But what Joseph does is two big things. One is he teaches Pharaoh to manage famine for profit. That's what gets him out of the prison and the gold chain and the big SUV and the whole thing, the prize package he gets there at the beginning of the story. But of course, Pharaoh's a racist, so he won't eat with him. Right? He'll use him because he can interpret dreams and, you know, make money for Pharaoh. But it says to eat with the Hebrew, which is a pejorative slur word. We've lost that in history because we've used them interchangeably. But the word Hebrew is a pejorative slur word for Israelites. It's very closely parallel to calling Mexicans wetbacks. It means a crosser. Hebrew means a crosser. So it's like an illegal alien. Pejorative word for an illegal alien. Israelite, of course, is the name that the people claim for themselves, the sons of Israel. So it's an abomination for Hebrews to eat with Egyptians, or the other way around, for Egyptians to eat with Hebrews. So Pharaoh will give him the gold chain and the prize package, and he'll even set him up with a priest's daughter as his wife. And Joseph says, I'm no longer an Israelite, basically. I'm an Egyptian now. And he makes it in Egyptian society, and he toys with his brothers, and then he does something which readers casually want to say, isn't that wonderful when he goes, hey, it's me, it's Joseph, and you know what? I got this deal with Pharaoh, it's all good, you know, God's behind this whole scheme here, and go get Dad and everybody else, and come on down here, I'll get you the best land of Goshen here, it's this nice fertile farmland, and you can settle there, and it'll all be good. And most of us go, yay! What has he done? He's led them out of the promised land. You know, he's convinced them to make a deal with empire and to leave the land that, you know, their great-grandfather, Abraham, left empire in the first place to go settle in the land that God would show. Is the land that God would show them Egypt? Don't think so. And of course, although I'd say in the book that the actual narrative of Exodus story is several centuries older than the Genesis story, which is to say the Genesis authors know well the story of we were slaves in Egypt and God's mighty hand drew us out. There's no brief narrative that's repeated more times in the Hebrew Bible than that line. Remember, you were slaves in Egypt and my mighty hand or God's mighty hand drew you out. Whereas the Genesis story is hardly remembered in Hebrew scripture because it's written later. But however, somebody wrote the bridge story that makes them continuous. The way the bridge story goes is, you know, Genesis appears at one level then, and they lived happily ever after in Egypt. But the Exodus story says, Pharaoh died, and another Pharaoh came along who didn't know Joseph, and now they were all slaves. Because that's what happens when you make your peace and security reliant on a deal with empire rather than with God. Because kings and emperors come and go, and the deal's off now. You know, it was good under one pharaoh, it's bad under this one. and it's too late to make up for it. But, so in addition to that, in addition to leading his own people out of the promised land, I got coffee on my screen here, but it's all right.
He's been baptized.
Yeah, thank you. So we have this scene here. This is after it's all, Joseph provided his father, his brothers, all his father's household with food according to the number of their dependents. Okay. Now there was no food in all the land, for the famine was very severe. That's what brought Abram to Egypt in the first place in chapter 12. And the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And what does Joseph see here? A chance to get Pharaoh really rich. This is what empires do. They profit off suffering. And it could hardly be more explicit than in this scene here. It's just systematic. Joseph collected all the money to be found in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan in exchange for grain and brought the money to Pharaoh's house. And when the money was gone, they said, "Give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? Our money is gone." And he says, "Give me your livestock and I'll give you food." And they bring the livestock in exchange for food. And now the food's gone again. And shall we die before your eyes? You know, buy us and our land in exchange for food. We will, and our land will become slaves to Pharaoh. Just give us seed so we may live and not die, and the land may not become desolate. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. We might call that privatization. All the Egyptians sold their fields because the famine is severe upon them, and the land became Pharaoh's. As for the people, he made slaves of them from one end of Egypt to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, because empire always relies on controlling priests to tell the story of the religion of empire. Always. You know, the priests get a tax exemption. The priests get something special, so they can be beholden to empire and tell the story that justifies the way it is. And Joseph said to the people, "Now that I have this day bought you and your land for Pharaoh, here is seed for you, sell the land." And the people say, "You've saved our lives." Now that's as blatant a story of how the religion of empire works as you could ever get. You know, first the money, then the livestock, then the land, and our very lives, and they say, "Thank you very much for making us your slaves." Okay. Right there in Genesis. This is Joseph's doing. Totally Joseph's doing. It's not Pharaoh's idea. It's not obviously not God's idea. It's Joseph's scheme to get it all pushed into Pharaoh's corner of the table. Okay. I still think Joseph's a good guy. You think I'm spinning the story? It couldn't be more blatant what it means, could it? I mean, there's nothing ambiguous in that text. It's a systematic act of empire. You know, just exchange food for everything. You know, it's the point that Dostoevsky understood in The Brothers Karamazov when Ivan tells Alyosha the story we know as the Grand Inquisitor. People will gladly exchange the freedom that Christ wants to give us in exchange for food security. And the church, the story says, is perfectly willing to be in on the deal and do it in the name of Jesus. And so in that story, the Grand Inquisitor says to Jesus, "You know, tomorrow I'm going to burn you at the stake and people will celebrate us." So that's the way that goes. We've replaced you. There are a lot of implications here for how the religion of empire is carried out in the name of Yahweh in the Hebrew Scripture, in the name of Christ in Western history. We've just got about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to point toward a couple more positive endings here. That was the happiest story to end on. So let's go to Romans 8. Here, Paul's talking to the Romans about their suffering, their being a church in Rome, after all, the suffering of trying to live differently right in the midst of empire. And he's trying to give them, you know, this pep talk to say, A, you're not alone, and B, you ain't seen nothing yet in terms of what the promise is. "So I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us. For the creation waits and with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. And this passage, I don't know, maybe you've already used it the way, is one of the most powerful statements for why Christians need to be involved in eco-justice. The earth, you know, salvation depends upon the children of God to set it free. It's waiting eagerly for that. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it. And sometimes people read that as if it's God doing it, which makes no sense at all. Why would God subject the earth to futility? Why would creation be eagerly waiting to be set free from something God did to it? Let's just take one classic passage from the Roman historian Tacitus to illustrate how, in Paul's time, people understood what empire did to the earth. This is just a brief passage. I took it from later in my book. This is from Tacitus writing in the mouth of a conquered Briton, Calchagus, about their experience of Rome. Remember, this is an insider. This is a Roman historian saying this about Rome. Robbers of the world, having by their universal plunder exhausted the land, they rifle the deep. If the enemy be rich, they are rapacious. If he be poor, they lust for dominion. Neither the East nor the West has been able to satisfy them. Alone among men, they covet with equal eagerness poverty and riches. To robbery, slaughter, plunder, they give the lying name of empire. They make a desolation and call it peace. That's written by a Roman historian, putting it in the mouth of a conquered person about Rome. You know, Romans well knew that the Roman Empire destroyed the earth. War, again, it's something Sharon mentioned, how war is such a destructive thing on the earth. And, of course, so is the intensive agriculture that they use to exploit people and pay their army and all that kind of stuff. So that's what Paul's talking about here. He's talking about the futility of creation being subject to the power of empire. But the creation will itself be set free from its literally slavery to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit grown inwardly, while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. Elsewhere, Paul continues on this theme in ways that translators can't work with because Paul's language is more urgent than English translation can get to. So here he says in 2 Corinthians, if literally there's no verb there, if anyone in Christ, new creation, exclamation mark. But here it says there is a new creation. If anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation. Everything old has passed away. See, everything has become new. And if you think that's a one-off thing, let's see. We can hear him say the same thing in Galatians. Neither circumcision nor uncircumcision is anything, but new creation is everything. Now, I'm not a Lutheran, and I have nothing against Lutherans. But I wonder what went wrong. Given how much time Luther spent on Romans and on Paul, he didn't hear that if you're in Christ, it's all new. We're not in sin anymore. You know, we are restored to the image of God that we were created. The, if you want to call it the fall, has been undone. I don't know how he missed that. You know, because it's quite plain there. If you're in Christ, you are new creation. It's done. And of course, the book of Revelation, which Luther hated, makes the same point. I saw new heavens and a new earth. The promise from Isaiah 65, someday there'll be new heavens and new earth. I saw it, John of Patmos says. And in that seeing it, it says, God says, it is done. It's not a promise for the future. It's not someday, one time, when Jesus returns, whenever that's going to be. It's done. What are we waiting for? What are we expecting God to do that God hasn't already done in the death and resurrection of Jesus? You know, it's done. We are new creation. The baptized are a new creation. You know, that is the point of Jesus' death and resurrection. You know, is to restore to us the capacity to be who we were called to be, which in this passage he calls children of God. The word that's back in 2 Corinthians translated adoption is literally sonship, which is to say, and this may be startling to us, that he expects us to have the same relationship with God that Jesus had. If we call Jesus Son of God, he's saying, we're sons of God. We're children of God. The point that Sue was making earlier in the week, that at least the Eastern tradition understood, that the goal of the Christian life was that we would be deified. In Greek, theosis. That we would become God. Not the way the Garden of Eden says was the wrong way, which is to reach out and lust for it, if you will, to kind of make it something that we have happen, but to receive this gift that God's giving us to allow us to be, you know, those through whom the image of God shines. So that when we see each other, we're seeing God. So last night in the forum, we were talking about listening, and people talked about, you know, listening to God, both in, as Sue was saying, in silence and solitude, but also through one another. We can only do that when we really trust in this promise and allow that image of God, the glory, the visible radiance of people through whom God's living, to be seen in one another. And we know what that looks like, don't we? We know when we see people who have that glow, that something, that light in their eyes, that presence that draws us to them. As Sue was saying earlier, there's an erotic power to that. It's not to say we're all supposed to be having sex with each other. It's to say our bodies are drawn to be close. It's something Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote about in his work on community. You know, that Christians are drawn to be in the presence of other Christians. Isn't that what Holden Village is about here? I mean, we could all come on our own and go hiking, you know, but we're drawn to be in the presence of others where we can see God at work and be strengthened by that. That's kind of what church is supposed to be. So that's all flowing out of Paul's and Jesus and John of Patmos' understanding of Genesis. And the last thing, I know I'm slightly over time here, but I just want to highlight one more thing just in passing. So in a passage in Matthew where after Jesus has told a rich man that if he wants it, he's got to give away his wealth, and the disciples are shocked because they've taken in the Kool-Aid of the religion of empire and think that wealth means you're blessed. And Jesus says, no, it's not that way. And he tells them here in the New Revised Standard, it misses the point. In verse 28, you see Jesus said, I truly, I tell you, at the renewal of all things, when the Son of Man is seated on his throne of his glory, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes, etc. The word for renewal of all things in Greek is palingenesia, when it's Genesis again. Truly, I tell you, when it's Genesis again, this is what it's going to be like. That's the heart of Jesus' message. It's supposed to be Genesis again. Not nostalgia, not a kind of longing for the past, but the restoration of what God's plan has always been for creation and for human life. Okay. Well, thank you for allowing me to go a few minutes over this morning, and thank you especially to all of you who've come, and I want to give a special thanks to this pair of people here. I don't know if you had a chance to meet Dave and Ada. If you haven't, take a few minutes with them. They are an inspiring pair of folks, and you might not know by looking at them, but they've been married for 58 years. And it's quite obvious they still so love each other, like I'm sure the first day. So thank you for being such an inspiration, and thank you all for being willing to walk through Genesis with us this week.